Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Versus History. I am Dr. Elliot L. Watson and with me is co-editor, as always, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. How are you, fella?
I'm very well, Elliot. Good to see you, sir. It's good to be here. It's good to be back with Versus History.
Yes.
It's me, History Chappy, and it's good to be with our wonderful listeners.
Yes.
How are we all?
Well, I'm very good. We've had a very productive last couple of weeks, what with publication releases. The new publication on Lord Durham is out there and it's doing very well. Anybody interested for A-level or just as a general reader on British imperialism in Canada or elsewhere might want to pick that up. Anyway, what's on the agenda today?
An interview, sir.
Oh, an interview, that's right. Now, a couple of days ago, Patrick caught up with a chap called Lars D.H. Hedbaugh, and he is a novelist of the American Revolution, a novelist of some repute, and you held a very, very interesting discussion slash interview with him. How did that go?
It went very, very well. It was a topic of great significance to us in 2018. If you've been to see Hamilton, you'll probably enjoy that. If you are interested in the American Revolution and why the Americans speak English but are not subject to the crown, or if you're just interested in global politics and history generally, I think you'll find it a really interesting interview.
Oh, fantastic.
Let's get on with it, shall we?
Welcome to Versus History. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Lars Hedbaugh. Lars, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to come on to Versus History with us today. Thank you very much.
I'm very happy to be here.
Lars, now I know you have a particular penchant or passion for the American Revolution, a particular interest shared by many of our listeners in the UK. That hasn't always been the case, but with the Broadway musical Hamilton and the CD that accompanies that, I would suggest that many people in Britain, their interest has been spiked by that and the very recent royal wedding. So there's definitely an interest in the history and legacy of the connection between Britain and the United States.
Absolutely. I'm actually sitting right in front of one of the books from the Hamilton musical, and of course I have the wonderful biography here as well. My take on the Revolution, though, I mean, we've all heard about Jefferson and Washington and now Hamilton, and we hear that, you know, all this stuff happened in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, but the Revolution took place across all of the colonies, and it could not have happened without the involvement of all kinds of ordinary people throughout the colonies. And to quote slightly from Hamilton, somebody has to tell their stories. Who tells their stories? That's me.
Of course.
And so my project is to essentially write one novel for each of the colonies who were involved in the American Revolution. And that is not just the original 13, as we tend to refer to them. I've written about a couple of the colonies already that stayed loyal, including West Florida and Nova Scotia.
Okay, yes.
I've written about Maine, which was just a part of Massachusetts colony. And I've written about Vermont already, which was an independent republic. Thank you very much. Declared independence both from Britain and from New York,
okay,
just for good measure. So, and with each of these stories, I'm basically trying to find angles in the Revolution that haven't been well considered in fiction in the past. So, for example, my Nova Scotia book is told from the point of view of the Loyalists, and the bad guys in it are definitely the Americans. My book based in New York is told from the point of view primarily of the Iroquois Nation, which was ripped asunder by the Revolution. It really had nothing to do with them. You know, it was the British and the Americans fighting against each other, but they hauled the six nations of the Iroquois in and actually split that confederation apart. And, you know, for each of the books that I write, I find some story that I feel hasn't been told or hasn't been told well, and I do my level best to tell that story faithfully and, you know, with a great deal of compassion for the experiences of the people who were actually involved, the ordinary people. And, you know, I actually make a conscious effort to keep the historical figures off stage, if you will. Number one, because it's been done. Number two, it's really easy to make a mistake and get called on it.
Yes, of course, of course. So Lars, let's say one of our listeners has, or one of our younger listeners has a spare £10-£20, $10-$20, €10-€20, and they want to purchase one of your works. Which one would you suggest or recommend that they purchase, and how could they get hold of it?
Well, I have a brand new one coming out just this week called The Freedman. That one's based in North Carolina. It will be priced on Kindle at $5.99, €5.99, or I believe it's £4.99 in pounds. It should be available basically any place where your listeners might be. If they don't have Amazon Kindle available to them, it will also be available on Kobo. And if somebody happens to be listening before the 31st of May, it will be available for pre-order. And of course, it's also available in paperback if you can get delivery from Amazon or one of the other, you know, major booksellers. So that's the new one. I have 8 others already in print. So if there's something that piques your listeners' interest, those are certainly available. I also have just starting this year, I'm working on getting audiobooks made of my books. So the first one of those just came out, I think, last month, maybe a month before. And that one's The Declaration, which is based in South Carolina.
Okay.
And again, that's available through Audible and iTunes.
Brilliant. Lars, you sound like you've been very, very busy. So listeners, if you are interested in the American Revolution and this particular interview spiked your interest, why not go and purchase one of Lars's many, many books? Okay then, Lars, let's get into the substantive knowledge here, the substantive history. When did the trajectory towards independence for the American colonials begin? Or, in other words, what was the original cause of the American journey towards independence in your view, and why?
Based on my study and you know, the stories that I've read of the experiences of ordinary people, as well as, of course, the many volumes of commentary that we've gotten from the era of the Revolution, my sense is that the end of the policy of benign neglect marked the beginning of the end of American loyalty to the crown. You have to understand that at the eve of the Revolution, the colonies were populated, as most frontiers are, by people who had, for one reason or another, chafed under the societies from which they had come. There were some established centers of population and culture, but the country was just full of people who really valued their freedom from any sort of government control. And when that was threatened, the seeds of revolution were planted.
Slightly different question, but quite similar in some ways. The question we've just asked is, where did this movement towards independence begin? On a slightly different note, what do you consider to be the fundamental or ultimate cause of the American Revolution in your view, or the most significant cause?
Well, ultimately, I feel like it came down to a clumsy and sudden assertion of control over the colonists by the British government. You toss a frog into boiling water and he'll hop right out. You put him in cool water and then put that on the fire and he'll sit and comfortably wait to come to the boil. The Parliament and King George started with boiling water and the Americans hopped.
That's a very succinct metaphor. Thank you very, very much indeed. Okay, what do you consider to be the factor that finally pushed the Patriots over the edge into outright rebellion? Because we are taught in school here in Britain, we're taught that even into the 1770s, George Washington was clinging to maybe some sort of conciliation. Benjamin Franklin had spent a long time in London and didn't necessarily want revolution in the 1750s and 1760s. So what do you consider to be the tipping point? What pushes the Patriots over the edge into outright rebellion, in your view?
In my view, I think sending army troops over in response to a protest or a series of protests against custom duties and having them patrol the streets of Boston and other communities in a show of naked force was just a terrible move. Military forces only know how to respond with military force, and that gave the rabble-rousers among the Patriots plenty of material to work with. But finally, making the Americans house and feed their own oppressors through the Quartering Act was the last straw.
Okay, is that the Quartering Act 1765 or the Mutiny Act?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Fantastic. Okay then, moving on. This is the big question, I suppose, that perplexes many students. Britain was the superpower of its day. It had just vanquished the French and the Spanish in the Seven Years' War with George Washington's help. I suppose the Americans would call it the French and Indian War. So Britain emerged in 1763 supreme. Britain was the superpower of its day. It had essentially destroyed the militaries of the other superpowers. How on earth did Britain come to lose this conflict by 1783?
Well, in my view, there are a number of factors, not the least of which was a simple problem of logistics. Supporting an army on the ground was hard enough for the Americans, but it was much harder for the British, who had to ship over replacement troops and many critical supplies all the way across the ocean. As you mentioned, the fact that the 7 Years' War, which again, as you said, we call the French and Indian War, had been ended, but the underlying conflicts hadn't been resolved. So the other European powers were definitely itching for a chance to get some revenge, and as soon as the outbreak of the American War of Independence gave them the excuse, they all jumped on. Finally, I think that there was a very real sense among the British populace and their representatives in Parliament that the Americans had some legitimate grievances, the most important being the fact that although there were just almost as many, or if not more, British citizens on our shores as there were back in Britain, we had absolutely no representation in the British government, no formal representation. We had to rely on the goodwill of a couple of members of Parliament who informally represented our interests, but we had no voice in our own government. So the refrain of no taxation without representation, I think it really resonated not only on this side of the Atlantic, but to some degree also back home in Britain.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Lars. As we know, Lord North, obviously the King's Prime Minister, supported the war because he had to, but wavered in his convictions. But we do know the head of the opposition, Fox, was against the war. So that definitely has some traction. Could I ask a counterfactual question, if that's okay? Let's say then the Americans had been gifted some representation in Parliament. Let's say Benjamin Franklin's wish had come true and America could send MPs to Parliament. Would that have meant that the Revolutionary War didn't happen, or would it merely have been delayed?
I think that would have taken a lot of wind out of the American sails, for sure. I do think that ultimately the idea of the breadth of the American colonial expanse being managed from afar was probably not going to be, you know, sustainable in the long run. As you may know, other colonial powers had similar issues, and in fact, if I remember correctly, the Portuguese wound up actually moving the monarchy over to Brazil for a little while. So it's possible that we would have seen something like that happen. I do think that there were other strains in the relationship between the American colonies and Britain, not least of which was slavery, which obviously ended up costing us a terrible civil war just a couple of generations after the American Revolution. And I don't think it's too difficult to sort of project that same question may well have caused a different kind of civil war within an extant British empire of the 19th century.
Okay, moving on. This war was a long one. Most people, I think, concede that it started at Lexington and Concord in the northeast, but then it was punctuated by key battles such as Saratoga, Trenton, and then disastrously for the British, Yorktown in 1781, and then it formally concluded in de jure terms with the Treaty of Paris in 1783. What do you consider, Lars, to be the main turning points in the Revolutionary War, or the main points of interest?
Well, Lexington and Concord certainly marked the beginning of open war, but that conflict, that skirmish, was preceded by a number of smaller skirmishes, including the burning of the Gaspé, which was a British revenue cutter that was rather enthusiastically enforcing British taxation on American trade. Her commander pushed just a little too hard, though, and he managed one night to run his ship aground as he was pursuing an American ship. And so some of the local merchants/smugglers heard about this, and they went out to set fire to the ship. In the process, the Gaspé's commander was shot, which, in my opinion, marked the first actual act of war by the Americans against the British. As for the other turning points that you mentioned, yes, Saratoga convinced the French that that we were a tenable force. But my favorite underappreciated turning point was the seizure by the Spanish of the British fortifications along the Mississippi. They had assembled a force to sail up the river, but just before they were to depart, a hurricane struck, wiped out the fleet. They went overland instead, took the river out of British control with only minimal bloodshed. This, of course, prevented the British from even considering any kind of an overland attack from the west, so it secured the Americans' rear, if you will. The thing that I love about that story is that wasn't the only terrible storm that that same Spanish commander overcame. He was struck time and time again by terrible storms, and each time he just returned stronger than ever and continued to the point where he took all of East and West Florida from the British before the end of the war. And his name is only remembered here in America, very, very sadly, in the name of our city, Galveston. He was Bernardo de Galvez. And at the time, he was actually promised that his portrait would be hung in the halls of Congress to commemorate his contribution to the revolution. We only got around to keeping that promise just a few years ago. But I am very happy to say that I got a chance to tell his story in my novel, The Wind. That is actually one of my favorite stories just from a pure storytelling standpoint. It's one of those stories that you listen to it and you go, you have to be making this stuff up. I'm just not. It happened that way. Finally, you know, as you said, the final confrontation at Yorktown, what I regard as a real turning point just before that was the fact that Rochambeau was able to mount an expedition, his expedition particulière, where he managed to get over here, landed in Rhode Island, and then marched down to Yorktown. And of course, that was the battle that finally broke the will of the British people and the Parliament to continue supporting the war against their American cousins.
Your really detailed response, I think, begs another counterfactual question. Had the American patriots not been privy to foreign intervention in the shape of the French or the Spanish, would they still have been able to win the war, do you think?
I think that they probably would have been able to drag it out for quite a while. I think ultimately the force of the British probably would have overwhelmed them, but it probably would have just wound up sort of setting up probably even decades of low-level guerrilla warfare. I don't think that the Americans would have simply knuckled under and returned to being, happy subjects of the crown. Having had a taste of being citizens of a republic, even for just a couple of years and under conditions of terrible warfare, I really think, chasing that back into Pandora's box would have been very, very difficult indeed.
I suppose final question, this is over to you. Is there anything that you would like to have mentioned that the questions haven't given you the opportunity to? Or is there anything you'd just like to share with us about the American Revolutionary War before we conclude?
No, actually, I thought your questions were really wonderful, and they let me talk a little bit about some of the things that I feel like are underappreciated about the revolution. The experience of ordinary people, the contributions of ordinary people, the ones who didn't make it into the pages of history books, without those, the history wouldn't have happened. And so having the chance to explore those stories, both in my research and in my writing, is one of the great pleasures of my life.
Fantastic. Okay, final question, I promise.
It's, sure.
The American Revolution isn't on every British syllabus, so some students might go through school never learning about it. Moreover, the Georgian period isn't on every syllabus. We often learn about the Tudors in Britain, then the Stuarts, and then we jump over to the Victorians. We miss the Georgian period out almost entirely. What would you want, say, British students to know? Let's say they haven't been taught it in school. The only education they're going to get on the American Revolution is via this podcast. What one thing would you want British students to know about it? What's the most significant thing? or what would you want them to know if they could only know one thing about the American Revolution?
That is such a fantastic, wide open question.
It certainly is. I'm sorry about that.
No. It's a great question. Boy, if I have 30 seconds to basically teach the American Revolution, I guess the biggest point that I would make is that listening to the complaints of your subjects, would have probably saved a great deal of trouble and expense and lives. But more importantly, the idea that we can resolve problems of this nature through brute force is one that I think the American Revolution actually disproved very, very firmly. Yes, we had help from the French and from the Spanish, but more importantly, we had a revolution in thought. And that's the thing about the American Revolution that I think is really unique in human history. Instead of being a squabble over which prince was going to control a patch of dirt, it was a fundamental fight over what the nature of government should be and what government's relationship with the people should be. And that to me is the unique genius of the American Revolution. And to miss learning about that, I think does a grave disservice both to the teaching of history, but more importantly to the understanding of human nature and, again, our relationship as individuals to our governments.
Lars, that was excellent. Thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. Thanks for answering those great many questions with such insight and panache. If you are listening to this podcast and you really want to buy one of Lars's books, and why wouldn't you, I will add in some links to his Amazon page and his website as well. So you can click there, get straight to his merchandise that way. Lars, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this opportunity.
Fantastic. Lars, all the very best. Thanks for joining us on Versus History.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe. Visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.